Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the War Report. I'm in Massachusetts. I'm in probably the second largest city in the state, and I'm afraid to pronounce his name because they pronounce it in a special way here. And for people who are not from here, when you pronounce their name wrong, you are in deep, well, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, I'm in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I'm just going to leave it at that. Have two very esteemed guests today, both university professors, both here in Massachusetts, and they both happen to specialize in the same area that is a very hot button topic, both here in the state of Massachusetts and across the country. And I was very, very fortunate that my first guest I'm going to introduce, I just met him Wednesday night. He was at the, it was University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And he was there to give a lecture to a full room of people. I had a chance to meet him before he did his lecture. And I got a chance to get to his lecture after I did my, 10th interview that day. And so he said he would love to come on the show, and here he is. And then my second guest is also an esteemed professor in that same area. I'm going to let him tell you what about this. And I asked him also, would he come on and talk about the topic? And he said yes. And I've got a real fear here, because if I mess up his name, this guy is a advanced black belt in karate. He will kick my ass without even working up an eyelid blink or something. So I'm going to hope that I can get it all right. So to start off with, here's my first guest is Donato. Would you introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your background? Donato? Well,
I am Donaldo Macedo. I am a distinguished professor at University of Massachusetts, Boston, originally from Cape Verde, came to the United States not speaking English, was able to speak it, and today I'm a full professor of English, which means that if you have access, good teaching, anyone can learn the language and succeed in this new country.
Okay. And was it Jada?
Yes, James. My name is Raza, and like Donato, I am also from Cape Verde. I came here when I was 12. I am today an associate professor at Bridgewater State University, and I am also the executive director of the Pedro Pires Institute for Cape Verdean Studies at that same university. I was the chair of the Department of Teaching and Learning at the University of Massachusetts, higher secondary non-individual university, and a public school teacher for many years.
Okay. Our topic today, as I said, is one that's raging here, is basically, I think, across the country, what is referred to as bilingual education. And the war, ever since No Child Left Behind, has just accentuated the conflict that rages across the country as relates to bilingual education. Should schools provide bilingual education, instruction in the native language, and for new immigrants or for people whose language is not English to begin with, or should they not? And as those of us who are educators, We know that this has been a raging issue for, I don't know, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and 2000, et cetera. Gentlemen, let's begin with what has been the situation here in Massachusetts over the last 20 years and how this war has accentuated any of the issues or controversies pertaining to bilingual education.
Well, let's begin with your question, should or should we not have bilingual education? That's an either or, and I think the situation is much more complex. The question that one needs to raise, why is it that colleges require that for you to be accepted, you must have a second language, at least some literacy in second language? And why is it that at the same time we have kids that arrive into our classrooms speaking another language fully and learning English? Why should they give up the language they bring to their classroom so they can learn English? Only later on, should they decide to go to college, they have to pick up a second language, and in most cases, they will relearn the very language that they would ask to give up. So the contradiction is so obvious, and then the other issue that one needs to also raise are immigrant children who do not speak English that come into our education system. Are they doing better before the law forbade instruction in a language other than English? The answer is no. They are dropping out, you know, at a greater rate. They're not mastering the academic discourse. They're not having access to literacy in English or in their first language. So the situation is much, 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 much more dire for these children. In fact, if I were to be if I had arrived in the United States right now, it would be unlikely that I would make it and be today a distinguished professor at UMass Boston.
Jetta?
Yeah, well, James, I mean, I would echo certainly what my colleague Donaldo is very accurately pointing out. As he noted, I mean, the situation is extremely nuanced. There are certainly a lot of factors that do not get taken into account. Well, take, for example, the issue of language research. Well, we certainly know for research in linguistics that the full immersion of students in the target language without support from the native language is not the best practice in terms of teaching. Yet, the very mandates that are set forth in the law require that this be done counter to what language research says is the best practice, says is the best way of learning. So I think, like Donaldo's pointing out, I think the situation is much more nuanced, and we have basically a whole generation of youth that are getting caught in the crossfire, so to speak. And I think that we will certainly feel the weight of this much later on down the road. I mean, certainly the youth are already feeling this. So the dropout rates, for example, for ELLs are higher. And because the dropout rates are higher, certainly other social effects are also more pronounced with respect to this population.
One quick question. When you were not born in this country, so when you arrived in this country, was bilingual education available for you?
Well, yes, it was. I think that Donaldo and I may have come at different times. For myself personally, bilingual education was available. I had the benefit of utilizing my native language for support until I mastered English. I mean, today, you know, I have written a few books in English, obviously, and so certainly the fact that I had access to native language while I was learning English was certainly not a detriment to me being able to express myself in English today.
Donato?
Yeah, I came, when I came in 1966, there was no bilingual education. It was sink and swim. I came around the time that immigration opened up for Africans, mostly Cape Verdeans. They had a linkage with the U.S. To the whaling industry. And most of my friends that came around the same time, none of them graduated from high school. And I often say that I'm an accident of history, because I happened to meet teachers that took special attention to my intellectual curiosity and my hardworking ethics and my desire to make it. So what you had at that time, it's what the state is trying to implement right now, sink or swim. Very few kids are swimming, and most of the immigrant children that do not master English are sinking. So that's a type of education that I think creates exclusion rather than inclusion. And we don't have to even come up with research data, because research data shows across the board that when you learn to read in your first language, you will read better and with more success and a greater achievement in your second language. So, but let's see how the capitalist state deals with the issue of second language. You know, if basically education is there to sell a product, i.e. education, you want to be able to communicate and give access to students so they will have the ability to apprehend the object of knowledge. So Coca-Cola, it wants to sell, more Coke, so to beat Pepsi Cola, and in communities, for example, heavily populated by Spanish-speaking individuals, they don't try to push Coke to young kids in a language they don't understand. They do it in Spanish, But the same thing, Nike. When Nike wants to sell more tennis, tennis shoes, now they'll do it in the language that kids understand, because what they want is to increase the number of customers. So in education, we are more reactionary. Rather than want to increase the participation of non-English speakers in the classroom so they can succeed and go on to college, we are saying, unless you speak English, you will not have access to quality education. And I'll tell you what happened to me. I remember in my first English 101 composition course, my professor recently graduated from Harvard. He wanted us to do a 40-page paper, and I didn't have the writing ability to be able to keep up, and that he wanted us to read 6 novels, very complex novel, and I also did not have the ability to do it without help, so I sought his help. When I sought his help, he told me, "Sonny, go learn English and then come to take my course." That's how I ended up, going to the Spanish literature department, studying Spanish language, studying literature, and become a Spanish professor before I became a linguist. Many, many years later, 20-some-odd years later, I end up becoming a linguist in the same department that this professor had told me to go learn English and come and take his course. Well, that he was practicing a pedagogy of exclusion. If I had flunked his course, one, I would have gone to Vietnam, because during the Vietnam War, and second, if I had flunked his course, most likely I would not have stayed in college. So here I was 20 years later, about 30 years later, the same professor who, by the way, changed radically, welcomes, non-English speaking students in class, loves to teach, ESL, loves the activities that we are engaging in, and so on and so forth. you know, I have and comes to me often to tell me I'm the best thing that happens at the English department. One second also often gives me his paper so I can edit his paper. So just to show you that we are not born, you know, with an English gene that determines if you don't speak it by certain age, you no longer will be able to speak it, you know, or learn it or master it, you know. All people, as a linguist, all people can master and learn a second, a third, and a fourth language. Only in the United States that we want to keep and maintain the society as a monolingual society, which is in direct contradiction with what's happened elsewhere all over the world through globalization, that most kids graduating from college, for example, in Europe, speak 2, 3, 4 languages, you know, fluently. And there's no way that this society will continue to compete, you know, with that type of education. Furthermore, coming from Africa, for example, Guinea-Bissau, even illiterates, even people who don't have access to literacy, who don't read and write in another language, but who speak 2 or 3, sometimes 4 languages fluently, in order to be able to have cross-communication among the various ethnic groups that with which they coexist. So language is extremely important as an education goal, and we should not really deny, you know, children, you know, the right to be educated, the right to have access, you know, to literacy in their own language, and the right to excel, you know, academically. By the way, you know, upper class individuals in the United States see to it that their children have access to a second language, and they do it, you know, both by taking, you know, language classes, either to two-way bilingual program, like French, English, and so on and so forth. But they also have the means to send their children abroad so they can master the language. So if it's good for the upper class, why is it no good for the lower classes? Not only bilingual education should be provided for the immigrant kids who don't speak English, I think bilingual education should be provided for all children, all American children that need to be able to have the edge, and that the edge in the future, in the 21st century, at least towards the end of the 21st century, will depend, you know, on your fluency in multiple languages. I'm not even saying 2 languages. It will have to be even more than 2 languages.
Let me come in. We have a caller, but before I take the caller, let me take the devil's advocate. You're in America. Learn American. Learn English. That's what you came here for. So why should we spend tax dollars to educate you either in your own language for the first 3 years and then immerse you into something else? Or why should we spend money to train teachers and divert our resources so that you, who came here voluntarily or what have you, your first job should be to learn the language. Yeah. That's the argument that's been around for years that I know of.
Nobody went in advocating for bilingualism or in advocating for bilingual education. No one is arguing against English. In fact, I'm very, very hard. I do English ESL teacher training. I'm very hard on pushing this point that the number one responsibility of teachers is to make sure that all students have good quality access to the academic discourse, the English academic discourse, which is also class based. Now, what I'm really arguing is that what do we really want? You know, first of all, let me just point out, I'm also a taxpayer. My parents also pay taxes. All immigrants pay taxes. And by the way, in communities that you have, you know, segregated immigrants, those communities that were decaying, you know, those communities become revitalized because of the presence of immigrants. So this is a democracy, and so we all participate. So if education is to give me access to quality education, and if that quality education is dependent on my ability to understand the object of knowledge, those concepts which are being taught in the language that I don't understand, you really wanted to teach those concepts to me, i.e. math concept, in a language that I can comprehend, you know? Now, it will cost the taxpayers much more money, certainly much more money, if, let's say, like in communities like Lawrence, Massachusetts, they're over 90% of the students are English learners, i.e. they speak English as a second or a third language. Now, if these 90% of children were not to go to college, then they will create a social problem, and it's been happening already, that will cost society so much more than what would cost to basically provide special English instruction so these children have a chance to do what I have done and to do what Schwab have done. What I mean is...
DeVaro, let me cut in again. Dr. Rosa, would you had something you want to say, and then we'll go to our caller.
Actually, I mean, I'm echoing Donaldo's sentiment here. Here's the reason why. I mean, if you look at English language learners, I mean, this overall issue of bilingual education at its current juncture, it cannot be extracted from the overall neoliberal project. Okay, and the reason that it can't be done is because at the moment, again, the discourse is one that's based more on mythology than anything else. The devil's advocate that you just played, the notion that if you are in America, you need to learn English and so forth, is coming from a discourse that somehow people are staying contained with their language systems, and they're not learning English. In fact, if you look at language research has shown, is that for immigrants, by second and third generation, those folks no longer speak the native language. They're speaking just English. In other words, today, we have more languages spoken in the United States than before, but by the same token, people are losing their native languages faster than ever before. So by second and third generation, people no longer speak the native language. That's one dimension. The other dimension, as I was saying, is that you cannot expect from the overall neoliberal project, because the way that the matrix that's being used to measure a comprehension of English or learning of English, standardized test. So beyond not access native language to learn content, at the same time, English language learners are being punished dually by being submitted to these standardized tests that are very much culturally normed, right? And that students have to work twice as hard to be able to do the same types of skills that other students have had from kindergarten on to learn. So picture a student, for example, coming in to a Massachusetts high school in the 10th grade, but the student has an academic lag. So he's coming in actually at the 10th grade, but he's operating at the 7th or 8th grade level. Well, this student has to, in 2 years, catch up basically to a student who has had native language instruction since kindergarten. So the student is being dually victimized. The group is being dually victimized, right? For the sake, of course, of profits. The sake of profits for these major companies who not only create the best, but all of the prep materials, and who also, by the way, if you attempt to get data from the state as far as how much money is being spent on these companies in terms of the preparation of standardized tests and prep materials and so forth, no data is available. Well, no data is available, but we're spending billions of dollars in these companies without any accountability whatsoever. So again, I mean, I think that the students are being really victimized, and this issue has to be brought to the forefront. I mean, despite the fact that in reality, living in a democracy in the 21st century, what you want is you want somebody in a globalized environment who can communicate in multiple languages and be able to integrate socially in multiple societies. What we're doing is we're doing the exact opposite. That is, creating the conditions where not only do we not have that, but even those students who attempt to get there, we dually penalize them. One, because of the standardized tests, and the other reason, of course, which is the reason that most people don't talk about, is the fact that many of these students are actually being railroaded in a sense to take alternative measures, alternative programs, so that their scores don't go on the district scores and not in the middle of the district scores, which is a case that has...
Let me break in and see if we still have our caller. Because it might be a teacher, and it would be very good to have a teacher who's in the thick of this join us if she's still there. Caller, are you still there?
Yep. If you're asking about me, yes?
Yes. And you are?
Dr. Miller, hi there. It's Rose from Windham, Connecticut.
I know that. I didn't want people to know that I know you. This was supposed to be, you know, the anonymous caller. So now, who are you? I don't know you. This is Rose, people, one of my very good friends.
I'm Rebecca from Sunnybrook Farm.
Okay, Rose, what's your question?
Yes. Well, it's not so much a question as just an effort to acknowledge all the conversation. I'm sorry I'm late to be a part of it. I'm not nearby, but I wanted to... confirm all the guest speakers' perspectives in regards to being victimized more than twice, in regards to our backwards approach to a more multilingual, multi-societal integration effort, the insidious implication of undereducating for the sake of having a pool of working-class people. And instead of responding to these children as if they were the gifted and talented, considering them in a deficit model, considering them in at high risk and need. So I like everything that's so far being pointed out.
Okay, Rose, can you stay with us?
That was my commentary. Yes, sir.
Can you stay with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Say what?
No, I mean, stay with us on the program.
I'll try my best. It's a little tough, the connection, but the question, the NCLB shift, bilingualism to acquisition, and inverting the definition of our children instead of emergent bilinguals as now English language learners, really narrows their educational focus, right? And they'll only be successful based on the amount of English they acquire, according to the educational standards that the NCLB has promoted.
For so the audience, for the audience knowledge, what is the NLB?
The No Child Left Behind rewriting of the Bilingual Education Act.
Yes.
So that's where the 30-month limit came into play. That's where the constant annual testing came into play. That's where the punishing districts if they did not show acquisition growth came into play.
Okay, which will then allow me to segue to what I said in the beginning. How has this current war impacted our willingness, our eagerness, our reluctance to provide bilingual education? And this is an issue that is nationwide, and particularly here in, I'm told, here in Massachusetts, although Rose, you're in Connecticut, but can everyone talk to the impact of the war in their area on bilingual education?
Yeah, can I jump in?
Sure.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, I just want to congratulate the caller. She's right on the money. The idea is to start beginning, for us to begin to view these children as added value. They are already speaking a language, which is a highly complex system that will take an American seven, if not a lifetime, to learn a foreign language. So they have already a set of skills that need to be celebrated, appreciated, and they should be provided with access to further elaborate on those skills that they bring, you know, into the classroom. You know, second, I want to mention that if we do an analysis in terms, you know, cost, in those states that have passed English as the official language, which will end in abolishing bilingual education, like in Massachusetts, is so draconian that, in fact, teachers, you know, can be charged or be expelled without a hearing for instructing in the language that the students speak, but do not the students speak, even though the teacher speaks that language. You know, so and then you have in the same hallway you have Spanish teachers, French teachers, you know, German teachers trying to teach, you know, these language to Americans. So if you look at the states where you have draconian laws forbidden bilingual education, these are the very states that students are doing worse. You know, immigrant children are doing much worse. And if you look how much these states are spending, you know, to educate these kids, they're spending so much less. So if they really want to expand English instruction, one would think that they would be spending so much more money providing special programs, alternative methodologies and approach, but none of that is occurring. A very fine dissertation was defended about 2 weeks ago by, you know, my former student, David Nieto, where he shows very clearly that states that, in fact, impose English in a draconian manner are precisely those states that are not educating. In fact, are miseducating, you know, immigrant children. Right. And this is also very much linked with the assimilation theory. Now, think about a democracy that in order to be, you have to stop being. You, James, you have mentioned you're in America. Be an American. And some people even say, speak American. You know, think about a democracy that in order to be, you know, I have to leave my culture, my language, my Cape Verdeanness at the threshold of the classroom in order so I can become something else that the teachers don't even know what that something else is all about. So it is really a very unjust measure. It's a form of double punishment, and furthermore, is a pedagogy of exclusion. And we see the results. The results demonstrate that we are excluding kids, we are miseducating kids, we are sacrificing in a real direct way, you know, the next generation.
Well, Mr. Rosa, what do you have to say?
Depends. If I could also add one more thing. I think that as a teacher educator, someone who trains teachers, the fact of the matter is, even if you look at systems, for example, that, you know, do these high-profile ads so far on the success of their overall district programs, but if you talk to those teachers that teach inside those programs, I happen to live in such a city that the school district you know, gets these huge accolades and so forth in terms of how well they do district-wise in terms of testing and so forth. But if you talk to teachers from the same system, if you talk to them in the classrooms, I mean, the teachers really live a dissonant life, you know, because the teachers are also victims of the system, because the teachers recognize very well that the pedagogy does not work, that the system itself does not work, that the way it's being used, but they feel good to maintain the system, keep it on moving the system.
You're breaking up. You're breaking up. Maybe if you could change the position of the phone or something.
Sure. So basically the arguments that I'm making is that the very teachers who are charged with implementing these systems, when you have them in a pedagogical environment and you're breaking down, you know, these various factors, these very teachers don't believe in these systems. I mean, they understand, they see the systems as being morally wrong, as being unjust and so forth, but they feel compelled to push the system because this is what they're getting from the top. And worst of all is the fact that what you have in, you're having cross comparisons between systems, right? When in fact you have a system, for example, that has so many accolades, a district that has so many accolades, but the district itself has found ways to bypass these testing systems, and the district is being used to compare to another district and punish the teachers in these other districts. In other words, if you look at, for example, the... Hello?
Oh. Hello?
I just want to make sure I'm still connected there.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead. Finish, and then Rose, you can come in when you finish.
Yeah, I'm saying, for example, in Massachusetts...
No, we're losing you. We've lost you,
yeah.
I think, completely. Rose, you want to come in?
Yes. Well, there's a complicity to that piece. While there are some teachers that have that empathy, in the systemic way of things, there are a growing number of children who are in need of bilingual education, but the universities keep pushing out monolingual, white, middle-class types of teachers. And there's a glutton market of EEs, elementary ed teachers. And so the idea that ESL can replace bilingual education is, my suspicion, with accommodating the glutton of market, so to speak. Instead of trying to get bicultural bilingual teachers prepared to teach the emerging bilingual community, the system that we have in place encourages more intervention based on English, more tier three work on the emergent bilinguals based on English, because that is the controlling body. The white middle class is the controlling body of the public education system as I know it. So the piece about responding to children, I was repurposed after being master intervention as bilingual language support. And the first year, they took all my materials away, and I had to teach with the ESL piece. And I came to realize, and I did my research, that ESL is an inappropriate tool to use for pre-literate children. So I did it for 1 year, and I said, no more. I'm bilingual certified. I'm going to teach in the language of the children now. And the fundamental purpose of education in Connecticut was the acquisition of English. So Connecticut needed to acknowledge, no matter how long it took, it was worth the investment to allow the children to learn in their first language so that they can be very good at their second language. But there was a piece where they didn't want to invest in recruiting and maintaining bilingual teachers, bicultural teachers. And so as a result, they stuck to the 30-month limit. And then our children, while barely proficient in English, were taking mastery tests. And they were feeling bad. The districts were being punished. The teachers were being pressured. The bilingual teachers were being pressured. And as a result, this was a justification for dismantling transitional towards them. And simplifying things such as structured immersion.
Okay, let me come in. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to give everyone a chance to have a last comment. And then I'm going to take like 5, 6, 7 minutes to tell the people about this week's journey. I've been to Connecticut, Maine, now I'm in Massachusetts.
Yes.
I always give an update at the end of the show. So we got 5 minutes.
Well, thank you for
listening. Back on? Dr. Rose, are you back on?
I am.
Okay, let's finish off with you. You got about 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, James, as I said, I mean, for me, fundamentally, the pedagogical model that we have right now to teach English language learners is certainly lacking. I think it was something that's been put into the system for political expediency. I don't believe it's what's best methodologically in terms of dealing with the children. I certainly don't believe it's what's best in terms of language research. And I think it goes hand in hand with the very neoliberal imperative of testing. A testing model, a test-centric type of a society. And from my perspective, the folks who end up getting the short end of the stick on this thing are the very English language learners, so they're being duly victimized. Donaldo pointed something out earlier in the program, which I think is very key to this whole issue, and that is if you look at MGL 71A, or Massachusetts General Law 71A, which governs language instruction, what he, Donaldo, explained in terms of, parents being able to actually file lawsuits against teachers and so forth for the use of native language instruction, this is a process that can be applied retroactively. You see what I'm saying? I mean, and that just goes to show you how draconian both the legislation and mm-hmm. the way that we are approaching, you know, this very issue is. I mean, the parent act of which in the classroom. Ah.
Okay.
So,
okay. Donaldo, you got 2 minutes, and then we're back to Rose.
Okay. Rose and João are right on target. To me, the real issue is not about language. It's about having access to quality education. The real issue is one of ideology. The real issue is the fact that language remains the last refuge that one can be racist and with impunity, i.e., you can practice racism that leads to exclusion of children to quality education and not be accountable for it. So language is only a tool that we use in this society, in this highly conservative, era that we are experiencing today, that the president, the presidential candidate, Donald Trump, can basically disparage Mexicans, against people, accusing Rubio of speaking Spanish, even chastising, Bush for speaking Spanish, you see, and he goes up in the poll. Now, it's unthinkable in Europe or anywhere else in the world that would happen. So here we are, openly, blatantly practicing racism, in a very direct manner, and nobody seems to care. On the contrary, the mainstream Americans are basically embracing this type of nonsense that millions of children would pay a high price. The high price is lack of education, which means that they'll become disposable bodies in the long run because there will not be enough factory jobs or even service jobs for all of them to do. That's the real issue.
Okay. All right. Hold on, Rose.
Dr. Phillips?
Rose?
Wonderful.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I want to give you 2 minutes.
No, you don't need to give me all that. The gentlemen have covered all the major aspects of the topic at hand about the systemic oppression, about the plan for surplus labor, about the ideology, about the prejudice turning into bigotry and then creating a system of racism. It's all well laid out by your two guests at the moment, and I appreciate just having other people say similar things. Dr. Crash did this interview when this proposal was taking effect, and the wording was, do you believe that children should be taught in their home language so that they can gain academic success. And the people, the sample, said yes. And then he asked, well, do you think that bilingual education? And the people said no. So it's the way the question is framed, the way the terminology is used to justify a systemic approach of keeping a certain group of people undereducated and available for surplus work in the event that there is any work to be needed. So I commend the guest and Dr. Miller for having this topic at hand. Thank you so much.
So I'll stay on because I got something I want to say right quick, too. Rose,
okay.
I think you already know this because we've had this conversation, but Ruth Rodriguez and myself have been talking about doing a War Report Sunday show in all Spanish for several months now. Idea is that there is a huge, huge Hispanic population across the United States that don't know what's going on as it relates to the war that we've been talking about on this show for 20 months, and that they need to be part of the conversation, and it's going to be our effort to make them aware by speaking in their own language. Now, we have been talking about this project for a while. Now I'm here in Massachusetts where Ruth is, and we're now talking about it more and also expanding the effort to the possibility of having a sort of war report in Spanish on a regular basis with Ruth and another group of people. Now, folks, I don't speak Spanish. I don't speak Spanish. Now, something everybody has talked about. I learned some Spanish in order to get my doctorate. It was a requirement that I take, be fluent in another language at a scientific level. And Spanish was my language. I was in California. So I do. I can understand some of conversation, but I am nowhere near ready to conduct a show in Spanish. So if and when we do this show, I will start us off, and then Ruth and maybe Rose and Ricardo, we're going to reach out to a lot of people to try and get that first show in Spanish and then see about developing another show that will be all Spanish all the time. I won't have anything to do with other than trying to help out get it in order. Now,
absolutely,
you know,
fantastic.
That's my little contribution here. And I'm glad you guys mentioned neoliberalism because I've been talking about this for I don't know how long. I've got 5 minutes left. Don't leave, guys. Listen to this. A week ago, I was in Maine. I left Maine, I came to Massachusetts where I am now. Since I've been here, I got here late Tuesday, starting Wednesday, I've been in, I don't know, three different cities, and I don't know where I've been. somebody will tell me, well, you were here, yeah. Like, I know, I have no clue where I've been. But anyway, the night I met you, Donaldo, I did 10 interviews. From 9 in the morning to 8 p.m., that's why I was late coming to your lecture. I've done here and wherever I am in Massachusetts, altogether in the last 2 days, I've done another 8 or 9. I'm almost done 20 interviews in less than 2 days here. Very little sleep, folks. Travel hundreds of miles back and forth from one city to the other, but it has been incredible. There are some things that I've learned that some patterns that are emerging when I talk to teachers and when I talk to parents. Oh, and yes, I'm talking to students, high school students. I'm talking to community activists. I'm talking to administrators. And I'm going to share this later when I have a little bit more time. But the bottom line is there are some things that the rest of America needs to know beyond our resistance community. There are some things that the world needs to know about the impact, the harm, the suffering that people are experiencing as a result of being warred upon. When I tell you some of these stories, those of us in the community, you're going to know this because you're going to know some people who their experiences are exactly like the ones I'll be describing. I'll give you a hint. Some of the people that I have in mind now, their stories are heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
It is truly heartbreaking. And me running my camera, trying to listen and do the things that I'm doing, I almost cried in one of them. I'm a grown man, I almost cried. But anyway, I gotta tell you some of these stories a little later, but now is not the time. Other thing I want to do is say that you people know that I have a GoFundMe campaign going on. I'm bringing it up now because if I don't, my team will be all over me. I need to promote this to you, and so I'm doing it now. Those of the guests, if you have social media pages and et cetera, I'm asking you to alert your readers, viewers, people who come to your site about the War Report and the GoFundMe campaign that we have. Rosa, you already know, and so hopefully
yes,
you are putting it on your site. Now, Donato, you know, you'll put it on your site, and you know Rosa already, so I have to get that in because we definitely need the support. To finish up and going out, guess what, folks? Maine was not on my list. Everyone knows that by now. I had a fantastic time in Maine, and the guess what is, I'm going back to Maine. Silent there. Drum roll. I'm going back to Maine. I think I'm leaving either Thursday or Friday morning for Maine. Maine was incredible, people. The people that brought me to Maine, they were just incredible. I was in the Portland area, which is the largest city in Maine. I think that I got that right. But Maine is one of those states where it's a lot of rural, a lot of farmland, a lot of country, and small towns. The reception that I got from, I think, Republicans, and I think maybe even a couple of Tea Partiers, and some disaffected Democrats, was incredible. They have all crossed their party lines to join in an effort to stop Common Core, stop PAR, Smart Balance, and to bring back community control of schools via their elected school board. It was really something. Me, riding around in Republican and Tea Party country, I'm going like, ooh, and I'll just leave it right there. But they were beautiful to me. I mean, incredibly beautiful to me. And as I was getting ready to leave, they said, there are other parts of the state that you've got to go. They want you to come. Can you come back? And I said, yes. I had made that decision the first 20 minutes I was there. I got a ride from the bus station with Heidi, and I'll have her. She was on last week. And talking to her, driving back to her farm, she and her family, I knew that, one, I had stumbled on a gold mine in terms of what this project is all about. Heidi just blew my mind with her experience, 25 years in this war, and what she did to take me around to the various places and get the teachers in, et cetera, I knew that if they wanted me to come back, that I would. And if you guys are listening in Maine, I may be there as early as Friday. Okay, I'm out of time. Everybody on the show today, I truly expect that you will be back, either one-on-one or when we do our Spanish program and what have you. But in any capacity, I want you back on the show with me. And with that, folks, thank you for being here for me, and thank you for being all of you have been extremely good to me on this journey. And Rose, thank you, because I know people, I do know Rose. Rose is a friend, and she helped me both in Connecticut and in Massachusetts. Dr. Rosa, he has been my host here. I've been sleeping at his house when I'm here. And Donato, I met you, and you said yes before I could even get it all out of my mouth. Thank you guys very much. And with that, good evening, everyone, and have a great Sunday afternoon, evening.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.